ordinance issue, and Representative Gelser is attending to other issues, so we'll have some absences. But the plan for today, as you've seen the agenda, we will not be proceeding to work session on HJR 46 or House Bill 3047. House Bill 3047 has been rescheduled for next Tuesday, the 23rd, and we will find another date for HJR 46. My plan past that is to continue with the public hearings that we started yesterday, finish those, and then proceed to the bills that were scheduled for today. So with that, we'll reopen the public hearings on House Bill 2347, 2731, 3421, and 3255. And I'm going to continue to call names from the list that was completed yesterday, and we'll do that in panels without much consideration of positions, but just simply rolling down the list. And given our time constraints, we'll try to keep this very short to 5 minutes or less per person. So first on our list, Susie Greenleaf, Stacy Gannon, and Rick Bennett.
Thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Susan Greenley, and this is Jeannie and Stacy and Damien. And I am here on behalf of other addicts. I'd like to start by saying I know it would be a great thing to do raise taxes on alcoholic and wine beverages in order to raise more funds for treatment-related facilities. That way more addicts and alcoholics who want and need help can get the help and support they need to learn responsible living skills, which ensures a more successful future for children with addict and alcoholic parents, not to mention the addict and alcoholic themselves. I want to state that many people today see alcohol as different than drug. Well, I want to say alcohol is a drug, period. I speak from the experience of having addiction. I have 3 kids, and due to my addiction problem, I have none of them in my custody. 2 of my children I gave up for adoption at birth because I was actively in my addiction. My 3rd child is currently in state custody, and because I am in a safe recovery home where I am taught responsible living skills, I am going to be able to give my youngest daughter a better life. I more than appreciate the recovery homes and treatment facilities that have helped me on my path. I strongly believe that by raising taxes on alcoholic and wine beverages in order to get more funding for facilities that are treatment related, more people in addiction can get the help and support they need to recover and change their lives. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'm Stacy Gannon, and I just want to let you know that DHS and the treatment centers are a vital part of creating a future for myself and for, most importantly, my children. So to get funding would be, there's such a great need, and DHS has been a really important part in the treatment that we've gotten for drug addictions, especially for the future of our children. And thank you for this opportunity to let you know that.
Thank you. Do you have any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Didn't see Rick Bennett, so we'll move along past on him. Marianne Schwab, Dr. Jim Lace, Judy Shipwreck.
Mr. Chair.
Last call. Representative Berger.
While they're coming up, I'd just like to say the last panel, I'm sorry I was late in coming. It's a very brave thing for you to sit down and talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Mm-hmm. Moving along then, Andy Shaw, Sharon, I'm a little nervous about trying the last name, Gordova?
Yeah,
she did. Okay, I'm sorry. We didn't have that on this list. Gina Nickel.
She's unavailable.
Okay. We're moving along the list rapidly. Daryl Larson. Okay. Jim Bruneau. Go ahead, Mr. Shaw.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Andy Shaw at the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for hearing our testimony. We're here in support of that bill that we weren't talking about yesterday at the informational hearing. We had hoped that Police Chief Rosie Sizer could join us. Then she got called away and wasn't able to come back down today either. But we were both going to testify about the need for increased local resources to fund enforcement. Cities receive a share of existing liquor funds and use those funds to support critical public safety services. We've passed out a report and some written testimony. The report talks about the kinds of alcohol-related incidents that police locally respond to. I think you can see on page 5 an example of the city of Eugene, some of the costs it has in responding to incidents that are directly related to the use of alcohol. And you can see towards the bottom of that chart, they estimate they spend on directly related incidents $2.7 million and receive $1.5 million in revenue from the liquor fund. So we're very supportive of efforts like that contained in 2535 to increase resources available to local governments. And I will leave it at that today, since I'm sure you have many other folks to testify. So,
thank you, Mr. Shaw. Mr. Bernal.
Members of the committee. Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Bruno. I'm the president of Willamette Valley Vineyards. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. With me is Gary Conkling, our representative. I sat through the testimony that you heard yesterday, and all of us in the room were very sad to hear it. We understand the importance of the issue that's before you and how you're trying to address it. Our testimony is limited to the issues of how your fiscal policy or tax policy will affect small and growing businesses in Oregon. Now, what I've done is I've done something a little unusual. I've handed out our company's financial statements to your selected financial information so you can see exactly what I'm referring to. Because the how you shape fiscal policy will greatly affect how businesses will grow, or jobs will grow, and opportunities will grow for our citizens. And not only do we have, or you have to balance the issues of what you face in this testimony of how to solve this problem related to alcohol, but also the opportunities for families and what happens to families when they don't have work or lose their work and lose their community. Communities are not developing. I also handed out the economic impact statement, which I don't know if you've seen, which shows that the Oregon wine industry has now produced, just in the lifetimes of when we first started, now over $1 billion of economic activity in Oregon each year. And in our lifetimes, it's grown from nothing in Oregon. The second thing I handed out was the growth of those wineries. Here you can see in the growth from almost nothing now to over 350. And the reason why I handed this out to you is because I wanted to show you how many young wineries there were in just the last few years. In fact, there's well over 150 very young wineries that exist today. The table you received, I think, from legislative revenue is very misleading. This table shows that Oregon ranks very low in the effect of its taxation on wine, and that's very misleading. And the reason why is because it includes taxes that we pay as producers directly before we produce net income, as well as what consumers pay. But it doesn't include the effect of the other tax policies on property tax or other taxes we pay as a business in Oregon. The last is I wanted to show you how does this excise tax actually affect the business, and that's what this spreadsheet does. That's what it shows you. It shows you our revenues over the years. I started the business in 1983, had our first crush in 89. So the data goes from 1995 to 2006. You can see the gross revenue, the gross profit. You can see the number of employee growth that's occurred in our business. And then the taxes we pay, state taxes and local property taxes, and the accumulated tax burden over time. But I want you to take your eye to 1998, where it shows a net income in the negative. Now, when Gary Fish testified yesterday, and he said that famous, wonderful, actually most successful brewery in Oregon faced bankruptcy several times, he was serious, and so did we. Here you can see in 1998, we had a negative net income of $72,000, but paid the state an excise tax of $81,000. Now, in order to make sure the bank didn't take our business, because we're out of compliance with our loan covenants, we cut our health insurance, and we did a lot of other things in our business to survive. Because a lot of people don't realize, when you have a mortgage and you pay your mortgage on time, the bank can't take your home. But even if you're making a payment to the bank on time, and you're doing it every month on time, the bank can still take your business when you're out of compliance with your loan covenants. When you add a cost to the business before it's net income, you can actually put that company out of business. And that's what was happening here. We were paying our excise taxes when we were going out of business. And we worked very hard to figure out how to overcome that problem. Over here in the end, you can see that over 22 years, we're producing a lot of golden eggs for Oregon to spend on its taxes. A lot. But my point is that we still have paid more in taxes than we've actually produced in net profit for our shareholders and our employees over that 22 years of time. So I guess to wrap up is to say that our Oregon wineries are still very young and vulnerable, just are these small craft brewers. We appreciate the solution that the counties are trying to develop to make sure that they do not adversely affect these small and vulnerable businesses and their employees. So when you devise your tax policy, we ask you to take very close consideration to those effects.
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. Mr. Conklin, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Conkling, and as Mr. Bruneau indicated, I represent the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I would like to just add one other item. Oregon wineries and their vineyard partners also are subject to a tonnage tax, which is $25 per ton. It's one of the largest tonnage taxes imposed on an industry anywhere in the country. And while it's true the revenue raised by that tonnage tax does go to pay for marketing and research, many other states actually contribute to their wine industries those kinds of funds for particularly research. We are self-funding the research to make sure that we sustain our industry ourselves. And that also is a producer tax that should be reflected whenever you look at level of effort for Oregon wineries in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kraft. Any questions? Representative Berger?
Just a comment. I deeply appreciate, Mr. Bruneau, that you're willing to share this kind of information with us. On your number of employees line, you have two figures. What does that mean?
Full-time and part-time.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I think it's a pretty graphic example of what happens in small businesses, how fragile they are.
The reason why I had, Mr. Chairman, if I can, just for a moment, the reason why I'm able to present this information to you is because we're publicly held.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we're one of the few publicly held wineries in America, the only one in Oregon. We're started by a whole bunch of Oregonians. And so I can share this financial information with you because it's publicly held. And many small business owners are very reluctant to provide this kind of information to you. But you can see, by looking at these numbers, just how your fiscal policy can change our economy.
Very helpful. Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, this is off where we're at right now on this issue, but I'm just curious. The corporation, are you an S corporation then?
A C corp.
C, okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, we're fortunate to have two county commissioners with us, Commissioner Carlson and Commissioner Nato. Come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. Lisa, you want to introduce yourself?
Lisa Nato, Multnomah County Commissioner.
The testimony that you're receiving is from us together. I chair the Human Services Steering Committee for the Association of Oregon Counties. Lisa chairs the Public Safety Steering Committee. We got together more than a year ago and started talking about how we might, from both public safety and human services perspectives, address some of the problems that we're facing as counties. I'm sure it's no surprise to you, given the testimony that you've heard to date and elsewhere in the building, that there are issues around substance abuse, particularly methamphetamine abuse. This impacts our jails, impacts the state prisons. And so we were looking for a comprehensive strategy on how to address methamphetamine and the associated problems. We brought forth a comprehensive mess strategy that has been adopted by the Association of Oregon Counties. We actually had a joint meeting in Eugene in November of the two committees, and that was adopted by the full legislative committee. There were some principles in that strategy that we adopted. One of them was that any cost recovery fee or tax would one focus on treatment, 2 focus on identified outcomes. 3 have proven or evidence-based practices. 4 would recognize counties as the mental health authorities. And 5 would use an integrated systems approach. And we have reviewed the various bills, including the unnamed bill, before you, and it is House Bill 2535, actually, that best fits the principles that that we supported as Association of Oregon Counties. Our legislative committee did take a position in support of House Bill 2535 on April 9th, and so we are officially in support of that. I was here in the building as a state representative in 2001 and 2002 when we had those wonderful special sessions, and then you all got to continue them in 2003, and as I'm sure you're aware, there were humongous cuts that were taken to substance abuse treatment, indigent care in particular, and then the restructuring of the Oregon Health Plan took a whole lot of people off the health plan entirely and took a whole group of people and said you don't get coverage for substance abuse treatment. So the great need was really created by the policies that we did, and granted we lost $2 billion and didn't have a lot of good choices during that time. But as we're moving forward, the population is growing, the need is certainly growing, and we're feeling the impacts of it. We believe that using jails as a mental health facility or as a place where people go to get treatment is not the best use, both from cost effectiveness and from a practice perspective for Oregon policy. And so that's why we're here saying that we need more revenues for treatment. Certainly we know that treatment works. On February 26th, Lisa and I helped coordinate a day when the House Subcommittee on, what is it, Women's Wellness? I'm trying to find the name of it. It's in my testimony here. Oh, it's Human Services and Women's Wellness. And then the Senate Health and Human Services Committee heard from Eric Martin, who is here today, and he'll be testifying. Tony Bigland from Oregon Research Institute and Dennis McCarty from the Oregon Health and Science University. And they testified some really great, compelling testimony. If you'd like to see those PowerPoint presentations, I can provide that to the committee on the fact that treatment does work. I think sometimes there's the myth out there that if we put money into treatment that it doesn't help people, but we have studies now that show that it actually does. And this brochure that you have in your packet talks about a number of those studies and gives statistics on the effectiveness of treatment. Finally, there is some information. The Association of Oregon Counties helped finance a poll in the fall. It showed that 62% of likely voters at that time would support a 10-cent beer and wine tax, and 45% strongly supported the tax. As you know, the bill that is before you does not include wine in it. It is simply a malt beverage cost recovery fee. And then I guess the last thing I'd like to say, and this is not written in my prepared remarks, is that I was a committee administrator to the House Committee on Children and Families when Liz Van Leeuwen was the chair of that committee in 1997, and Kitty Piercy was the vice chair. And we discussed at that time increasing the tax in order to fund prevention programs. And I probably have 12 different iterations of a pie chart. It took us 5 months, starting from maybe February and going into May, to try to determine, one, how we were going to divvy up the money, and then, two, once we divvied up the money, how it was going to flow. Those are the two things. I would listen to the testimony yesterday, and Senator Metzger said we can overanalyze this, and it's important to act. And I guess if I could leave you with any message, that is the thing that will kill action, because there's so much division in terms of how the money ought to be divided up. This bill, House Bill 2535, actually went through the process, and I was not part of that process last session, but the way it's been described to me is that everybody circled the wagons and shot inward. So now they're at a point where they have actually agreed to how that split happens, and it's a very, it's a compromise. As Don Bischoff said, not everyone's going to get everything that they want to the extent that they want it. But I think that you need to look at that carefully, because that was work that was done by the different organizations that have the need for the revenue, and they have all come to agreement on that particular split. And so I guess I would, the last thought I would leave you with is that it would be very important for you to take action on this session. We think that the time is now, and we'd like you to encourage you to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Commissioner. Commissioner Mato.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I want to thank Janet Carlson for her leadership on this, and I really want to thank you and applaud you for having these hearings on this matter. This is a matter of really importance to our communities, and particularly I speak from the public safety side. I'm a former prosecutor, and I chair our local public safety coordinating council. We all know that we have we pay a lot of money when people are arrested and brought into jails. They have district attorneys that prosecute, then they're appointed public defenders. The whole system is very expensive, and we have people, most of the people in our facilities have addictions issues. The evidence is really clear that treatment and is effective, it works, it's cost effective, and we can change people's lives when they go into recovery. It is just as successful as other kinds of treatments, treatments for cancers, treatments in the medical world. People can regain their children and save the taxpayers' dollars there. In addition to providing a better life for their kids, they can maintain employment, and overall it's a win-win situation both for the individual and for our communities and our safety. Right now in Multnomah County we have approximately 400 people waiting for residential treatment. We do a pretty good job of getting people into outpatient treatment because it's less costly, but even that, sometimes people are on waiting lists for 60 days or 100 days. It's very important that people get treatment at a moment in time when they're receptive to it. For instance, if they're told they're pregnant, that is an opportunity for someone to be highly motivated to go into recovery and get treatment. At a time of arrest is another time when people have a very high motivation to try to change their life. So there are moments that people are susceptible and more ready for treatment, and that is the time it has to be provided right then. We can't turn people away and say, come back in 6 months, because it doesn't work that way, and it won't work for them, and it doesn't work for us. They come right back, and guess where? Back into our jails. It's a cycle that we know about, and we know how to break it. And we have really good programs that make a difference. We just don't have enough resources.
Madam Commissioner, if I might have one just second, you can you probably
I'll remember this
from, well, I was just going to say from your time here before, if you could stand back, sit back a little bit for the microphone.
Too loud.
Getting word that it's getting a little distorted for the record.
Okay. So I just again want to thank you. That's really all I wanted to say. Both from a public safety side and a human service side, you could make a real difference for our communities and for the future of our state. And again, the time is now. And partly we're here because Janet is a Republican and I'm a Democrat. This is a bipartisan issue. This is an issue of importance to all the people of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Mainly I want to just thank you both for your incredible passion and advocacy on these issues. I also wanted to just ask Commissioner Nato you mentioned the waiting list, and could you say what the average length of time people are waiting to get into treatment is?
You know, we don't keep all of that information. I could get that to you. I've been asking for that. We took a snapshot at one point in time about a year or two ago, but we don't monitor, and we actually know a lot of people are falling through the cracks for that very reason, because if there isn't treatment available, then they just are kind of lost. So we do a pretty good job on the outpatient, getting people in, but it's the inpatient residential treatment. And I'll get that to you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you both for coming. Linda Fleming, Tom Eversole, and Mary Lou Hendricks.
They won't.
Okay, so I'll ask for a couple other people. John Kaplan.
Jan.
She is here. He is not. I'm sorry. And Bill Hall.
Commissioner Hall is not here.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Fleming. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials. We represent Oregon's 34 local health departments. I'm also here today on behalf of Gina Nickel, who was not able to be here due to a family situation, but she did want to make sure that I submitted some information for her to you, which is coming to you now. I actually lived in Fossil and drove down here yesterday to testify and was not called to testify, so I submitted my written testimony yesterday because I wasn't sure I was going to be able to stay over and be here. So you do have written testimony from me somewhere in your file. House, which I'm sure you will find. The Coalition of Local Health Officials and the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs supports additional assessments on alcohol, primarily beer and or wine. We, however, are taking the position that the methodology and the language and the process that's outlined in House Bill 2535, which I know you've heard a lot about and I'm assuming you will have an opportunity to review, best reflects a comprehensive approach to the prevention, intervention, and treatment of alcohol and drug abuse. It includes law enforcement, which we know is an important component, and it includes all of the social services, which we think are critical to forming a seamless approach to this problem in our state. We have had people ask, you know, what is it the public health does in this area? What do you see your role as being? And I would like to just give you a few examples of what we see as critical services to support the clients, their families, and the treatment provider community. For example, in one of our public health nurse home visiting programs in fiscal year 2006, we actually provided home visits to 9,176 individual infants and toddlers. Using our historic service data to compute what that means in terms of this specific issue, about 385 of those infants were born drug exposed. 156 of those infants presented with parental alcohol or substance abuse. We provide maternity case management services. Public health nurses provide maternity case management services for women who screen positive for alcohol and drug abuse. Interestingly enough, that's a voluntary reporting. They self-report their use, so we know that it is probably significantly underreported in terms of the number of women who are actually consuming alcohol or using some type of an illicit drug during pregnancy. Our screening and referral data reveals that there's a real interdependence between the public health and treatment community. There were actually 174 referrals for public health nurse home visits in fiscal year 2006 from a substance abuse treatment agency. The treatment provider was actually saying we need a public health nurse in the home to assist us in a successful outcome with this client. In addition to that, however, 697 referrals were made from public health nurses into the treatment provider community. So they're going into the homes and seeing some pretty dire situations that, as public health nurses with good assessment skills, know need intervention from the treatment community. We have other public health programs that play a vital role as first identifiers. All of our family planning and WIC clients are screened for alcohol and drug abuse and domestic violence. In 2006, counseling for substance abuse occurred in 5,131 visits in our family planning clinics, and we referred 320 women into some type of a substance treatment situation. In terms of relationship safety, we counseled 39,218 women and young women about domestic violence violence in the home. 203 of those women and young women were actually referred into domestic violence shelters and provider types of situations. So I guess what I'm trying to tell you is that we are a part of the very, very early prevention and intervention. We're dealing with the very young babies, just a couple of days old when they come out of the hospital, as well as those that may be trying to prevent a pregnancy. This, I think, demonstrates our need, the public health community's need, for a strong, stable and sustainable mental health and addiction services that are available and accessible when we need them, just like Commissioner Nadeau described to you. But we are also a critical support to them. They need us to help them be successful. I would like you to kind of have you look at the information that Gina Nickel asked me to give to you. There is empirical evidence on the effects of price on alcohol. Some of the questions you were asking yesterday, Gina has provided here for you, the relationship of price to adolescent drinking, the relationship of price to alcohol-related car crashes and deaths, the relationship of price and alcohol-related disease, price in alcohol-related violence, price in academic achievement. I would just like to point out, because I did mention some of the things that public health is interested in, higher alcoholic beverage prices reduce the rate of severe domestic violence, and increase in beer taxes leads to reductions in child abuse. I just think that's a critical thing that we can't overlook. Gina wanted to make sure that I pointed out to you, you have been asking for outcome data. The last two pages of her handout show the improvements, the account, and the outcomes between the beginning of treatment and end of treatment in four different areas. I encourage you to look at that. I think it's pretty self-explanatory outcome data that shows you know what happens when we invest in these types of prevention, intervention, and treatment services. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fine. Unless there are any urgent questions, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Fleming, are you in a position to be able to know, one of your handouts talks about the alcohol price and adolescent drinking. Are you in a position to be able to know, in terms of adolescent beer consumption, the beer of preference, would that be microbrews or from larger beer producers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I'm sure there are people here who can answer that question better than I, but just from a common sense, I think that probably whatever is the cheapest, mm-hmm. and your microbrews, coming from someone who went to a Blazer game last night and did support Widmer for one, it was $8. So I don't think that that's probably the beer of choice.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. I think if our records are correct here, that completes the list of people who indicated that they came from more than 100 miles. Is there anyone else who's come from that distance? Please come forward. And while you're coming forward, maybe I'll call a couple of other people who can get themselves situated. Stephanie Soares Pump, not here. Thank you. We're covering our list more quickly. Judy Cushing?
She's not here.
Great. Barb Cedar?
She's not here, but I have testimony that I'll offer.
Thank you. Deborah Gilmore? Perfect. And Carl Brimmer? There's one more seat. Also not here. Eric Martin? Please. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to start off, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. No one wants to be taxed,
If you could please identify yourself for the record,
sure.
too.
My name is Brandon Peterson. I represent the Reduce Underage Drinking Task Force and the Take the Time Be the Difference Coalition of Clatsop County, Oregon. Anyways, nobody wants to be taxed, but taxes fund the crucial government programs and organizations that are needed in this county and state. I think we can all agree that if alcohol as a product were not directly linked to causing problems such as car crashes, alcohol poisoning, and other serious issues, we wouldn't be here today. But the sad truth is that alcohol is known to be a part of these issues. I'm not saying that everyone who drinks is irresponsible, that we should enact prohibition. I'm saying that the state of Oregon should impose a tax on the malt beverages to help pay for issues that are linked to this issue. Let the consumers pay for a part of the $683 that every single Oregonian pays each year on alcohol-related issues. Alcohol affects many different age groups, and I'm here to talk about underage drinking. I'm only 18 years old, but if I want a beer, I can get one, whether that be from a friend, a parent, shoulder tapping, or myself going in and buying it myself. I have proven that true since I was 16 years old, participating in compliance investigations. I started volunteering my time in substance abuse prevention and treatment programs and stuff like that when I was 13 years old. I started out in the Clatsop County Peer Jury, which is a program that had first-time offenders as a diversion program come through the juvenile department. That program was unfortunately closed down a couple years ago due to lack of funding. I then went on to start the Clatsop County Youth Action Team, which was a program through Oregon Partnership, which was also closed down. I think these programs were very successful in what they did. We had a very high success rate in the Oregon Youth Courts with the peer jury. Most of the people that came through as the diversion program never came back through, which I think is something to be said of prevention. I know from my experience as being working in police departments for all these different organizations listed on the handout I gave you. There's a letter, and that's all the organizations that take part in our group. I can safely say that prevention definitely does make a difference in our community, and it definitely is something needed. I'd like to say that as a citizen of the state, that breweries, yes, they do deserve a return on their investment, but don't we as citizens also deserve a return on our investment and have a reduction in car crashes, drunk driving, and other serious issues? On this letter I provided to you, there's a letter from the coalition. There are also some statistics based on Clatsop County with underage drinking, healthy teen surveys, and other things like that. I'd be happy to answer any other questions, but I'm here to support the House bill, the one that we said is unnamed, but the one that does tax mostly malt beverages, but also helps support prevention and treatment.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for your service. I think we'll continue with the other folks and then see if there are questions. So you can decide which order you'd like to go in.
My name is Eric Martin, and I'm director of the Addiction Counselor Certification Board of Oregon. And I am also here to speak in regards to the House bill that dare not speak its name. And I have brought some information regarding Alaska, and I assume that everybody has received this packet of information. I'd like you to look at this one set of graphs, and I'm just presenting this information as a point of clarification in regards to Alaska's beer sales after they instituted what was the highest beer tax in America in 2002. Senator Murkowski put forward a beer tax that included barrelage discounting for breweries that produce less than 60,000 barrels. And she made a promise to her peers that if they voted for this beer tax with this barrelage discounting, that sales of beer would go up for small breweries in Alaska and that youth consumption would go down. She had a difficult time convincing her peers in the Alaska legislature that this would indeed occur, but she presented enough scientifically defensible evidence, credible research, to persuade her peers. They voted it in, and indeed, since that has happened, beer sales among Alaskan small breweries did in fact go up, and youth consumption did in fact go down. I brought some graphs to show you, but I also brought 7 years of Alaskan tax records demonstrating everything that I'm saying, because I want you to know that the information that I'm presenting is 100% bulletproof accurate. It's not a deception. It's not lying with statistics. It is 100% true. And I'm going to give these to Deborah now. And Deborah, could you give those to the clerk?
Certainly.
Okay. So the first graph that I want to show you is a graph that has all beer tax, or excuse me, all beers sold in Alaska from January of 1999 all the way to October of 06.
Mr. Martin, let me just point out real quickly, we've got to be consistent in our time. We've got about 3 minutes left, so just a little time check
okay.
So you can budget it appropriately.
Okay, well, I'm just going through these five graphs, and it's going to be really fast. So it also has large brewery sales and small brewery sales. Now, you'll notice, actually, I'm going to flip over, and this is just the same graph. It's just looking at one line. This is all gallons of beer sold from January 99 all the way through October of 06. And you'll notice that before the beer tax went into effect, there was a huge spike, a massive spike in sales right before the beer tax went into effect because people went out and stocked up. Now, if I did a research study and I looked at the amount of beer that was sold, say, 6 months prior to the tax and then 6 months after the tax, then it would appear that sales of beer went down in Alaska. But if I look longitudinally over the whole thing, and I sort of keep in mind this phenomena of people buying all this beer just prior to the tax going into effect, we can see that with a linear trend line, that sales did not go down. And if we look at large beer sales compared to small brewery sales in Alaska, small brewery sales actually went up, and that's the last graph that you'll see. Small brewery sales in Alaska went up significantly more than all other increases. So in regards to the idea that beer sales went down in Alaska after the tax, that is not the case. And Senator Murkowski kept her promise that, in fact, beer sales wouldn't go down. Small breweries would reap the greatest rewards, and youth alcohol use would drop as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Please. Chair Reed and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Gilmore, and I'm the executive director for the Oregon Prevention, Education, and Recovery Association. We are a private nonprofit association of treatment and prevention professionals who offer approximately 80% of all the public assistance clients' treatment and prevention services. I had submitted my testimony yesterday because I didn't know if there was going to be an opportunity to speak again, and so you have that. And as is with this building, 24 hours can make a huge difference. And at 11 o'clock this morning, I got a phone call telling me that my father had been taken to the hospital where he will probably die. And the reason that he's dying is he has abused beer specifically since the age of 15. We know from information that you have before you, alcohol causes an injury to the brain that triggers addiction. And that is something that a lot of folks have challenged. The data is in there. There are photographs in there to show you the actual injury that occurs to a brain, particularly an adolescent brain, in the process of consuming alcohol or drugs. As I look at this, I knew for a long time that this would be the outcome for me and for my six siblings. After I leave here, I get to drive to Corvallis and pick up my daughter so she can say goodbye to her pop. As a professional and as a person, I ask you to please demonstrate the leadership necessary to move House Bill 2535 forward. It's time that the beer tax that has languished in a frozen state for 30 years be thawed, and we finally get some services to treatment, prevention, and law enforcement that are necessary to address this issue. It's not going to help my father, but it will certainly help a lot of other children who are going through the same thing I am right now. If we had those services, we could prevent it. Damien is a perfect example. He's a six-week-old little boy whose mother has a lot to look forward to now. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here at what I'm sure is a difficult time. Do we have questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The same question again. Can any of you on this panel answer for me? And I think, Mr. Martin, your data is suggestive at least, but beer of preference for adolescents, so microbrews, or our more traditional macrobrews?
Well, anecdotally only. You can ask virtually any addiction counselor in the state of Oregon, and they will tell you that cheap beer is the beverage of choice among adolescents. I don't know if a research study has ever been done looking at microbrews versus high-volume cheap beer. But anecdotally, as I said, you can ask any of the 2,000 addiction counselors in this state, and I guarantee you they would all tell you that.
As a youth, I would have to say I don't have a lot of money to spend on $8 of microbrews, so I'd have to say cheaper beers are definitely the beer preference between my peers.
Thank you very much.
Further questions? Thank you all very much for coming. Next on the list, Mike Wilkerson. Mary Stewart, who I don't think is here. So, Mr. Wilkerson, while you're getting settled, I'll call a couple more folks. Brenda Narayan, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but no one's responding, so we'll move on. Rob Bavette and Art Lawrence. Go ahead, Mr. Wilkerson.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Wilkerson. I'm the undersheriff for the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Sheriff Ramirez, who is unable to be here. Some of you may know, Sheriff Ramirez is very supportive, vocal, and very active in efforts to deal with alcohol, drug enforcement, prevention, and treatment. And before I forget, I certainly want to ditto the testimony of Commissioner Carlson and Commissioner Nato and their testimony presented today, having to do with House Bill 2535, which we're not supposed to mention. But anyway, that's why I'm appearing. Just to give you a real brief background of Marion County Sheriff's Office, we're one of six sheriff's offices in the state that not only do law enforcement functions, but custody functions, which is the jail, as well as supervision functions, which is parole and probation. And just to give you a broad snapshot for the sheriff's office, especially in our capital city and where we're located, over 19,000 people in Marion County were booked into the Marion County Jail, which has a funded capacity of 528 beds. Those individuals who were fortunate to stay in one of those 528 beds, 70 to 80% of those have substance abuse issues. And the reason I say 70 to 80% because they're male and females. And what we're finding is that the females basically have more of a difficulty and problems with substance abuse than the males do. At least that's what we're finding as far as the reporting. And then I mentioned to you that we also supervise parole and probation. Out of those 4,400 offenders in Marion County that we're supervising, approximately 60% have substance abuse issues. I want to talk to you a little bit about a recent survey we did with our jail population. And we basically, and this is a self-reported survey of 442 inmates. And they revealed that they were responsible for 774 children in our community. In addition to the staggering statistic, 83.5% of those had and have had an immediate member of their family that were incarcerated either in jail and or prison. So you've heard testimony here about this intergenerational issue, about somehow we have to break that cycle. I can let you know that we do not, at the Sheriff's Office, have funding for the necessary not only enforcement but prevention and treatment services to deal with this increasing population. The funding that potentially can be generated by this bill would have a significant impact in providing the needed services to break this intergenerational cycle. And I would appreciate your support for the bill. Thank you, and be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. I think we'll take the whole panel's comments and then look for questions. Mr. Bovet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Rob Bovet, president of the Oregon Alliance for Drug Endangered Children, also here on behalf of the Governor's Meth Task Force. I am the author of the unnamed bill, 2535. It was actually a slightly bigger bill, and we decided to carve it up into two bills, which I'll only mention briefly. I won't go through the arguments that you've heard already. You've heard very passionate arguments. We need to ramp up state police funding. It's a tragedy what has occurred to them over the last 20 years. We need to ramp up treatment funding. We can no longer be 49th in the nation for treatment access for young adults, young women. Like you heard from before, need to be offered treatment before we take their kids. Every single day in the state of Oregon, we terminate the parental rights forever of young meth-addicted women. That must end. I provided you yesterday with written testimony that tells you what I wanted to tell you about the substance of the matter. I will tell you, however, just as an aside, it struck me yesterday when I heard the folks from the small breweries come tell you that the exemption we carved out for them in the bill wouldn't work. It wouldn't exempt them. And I think that is further indication that the structure that we have here in the state of Oregon needs to be addressed as well. And I encourage you to do that. As part of the structural changes that I had originally drafted as part of what became 2535, which is now Senate Bill 502, would have repealed some of that anomalous structure, which in a similar fashion up in the state of Washington last year got struck down by the federal courts as in violation of the antitrust laws. I encourage you to address some of the structure that essentially puts you in the position where you can enact a law that exempts out small breweries, but they won't get that exemption. You need to change that dynamic. So I suggest that, obviously, I have a predisposition to favor 2535, which I drafted, but I suggest that you you really strongly look at Senate Bill 502 and also adding a provision into this bill that gives our Oregon brewers the exemption that we intended them to have. That may require you to enact a new section in that bill that basically says those folks that are exempted, the distributors shall not level the playing field and level those taxes out to everyone. They shall focus in on the specific beers that are being taxed versus those that are exempted. I also want to let you know, as Mr. Bischoff did yesterday, I'm here, I'm willing, I'm ready to work with you, with your staff, and with any of the interested parties to craft a bill that we can pass this session to address some fundamental problems with the structure and also ramp up funding for the state police and for critically needed treatment. I strongly encourage you to move a bill this session. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brewer. Mr. Lawrence.
Hello, Art Lawrence. I own the Raccoon Lodge and Brew Pub in Raleigh Hills, and it's also called Cascade Brewing. I have a brewery there. I'm director of the Oregon Brewers Festival. We'll have our 20th annual festival at Waterfront Park this year. I'm also co-founder of Portland Brewing with Fred Bowman, and came down and sat in this very same room 22 years ago in front of a similar committee, and we talked about brew pubs. And that's where it got started, is in this room. So I've been around the microbrewery scene since it got started 22 years ago. I don't want to see this business get destroyed because of funding of social programs. I think the responsible brewers have gone out and created a nice business. I feel that if this taxation is done without any carve-out, that there's a rule, that they're changing the rules of business. When we came in here 22 years ago, yes, we did have the tax, but that is what we have predicated and worked our business on. And business is made up of many small little increments that all hold together, just like our body. We pull one part of our body out and it doesn't function. And you go start playing with the excise tax and pull that out, that changes the whole dynamics of your business. And I think that Jim Bruneau alluded to some of that. If it's necessary, create the carve-out. And just like Rob was talking, I had a conversation with my distributor on that very subject this morning, and I got a satisfactory answer from my distributor, because my distributor also sells yellow beer. And I refer to this as a yellow beer tax. And what Rob was just talking about is what I call a backdoor tax. And I don't want to see a backdoor tax for anybody. I want to see a level playing field for all of us microbrewers. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? You've convinced us, apparently. Thank you. Next on our list, Jamie Floyd, Ben Love, Brian Guttenschon. How did I do?
Good.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Reed and other members of the Revenue Committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come to speak before you today. My name is Jamie Floyd. I reside in 1560 Jefferson Street, Eugene, Oregon, and also own a business in Eugene. I am part owner and brewer for Ninkasi Brewing, which I started with my partner Nikos Ridge last year. I'm also a board member of the Oregon Brewers Guild and past president. I'm here today to tell you my story and urge you not to raise beer tax. I have been a resident of Eugene, Oregon for 17 years. I studied sociology at the University of Oregon with a focus in community studies and graduated in 1994. Despite the historically uncertain economy in Eugene, I remain in Eugene to pursue a postgraduate life in my community. I have also been a home brewer since the early 90s. My love of craft beer, brewed beers began in 5-gallon batches in the kitchen of my college rental. The rich brewing history in Oregon and the local agricultural connections to the ingredients have created a special place for craft beer to thrive. My passion for brewing is based on style histories, a fascination in the complexity of flavors, and the unique relationship beer and humanity have always had.
Mr. Floyd, we got your written testimony here. Yep. I promise we'll read it. If you could perhaps just say a couple of your main points, that would help us a lot.
Absolutely. I first want to say... it has taken 11 years for me to open my business based on the slow economy to pay back my debt to the university and to buy a house to have equity to be able to borrow the money. We borrowed $1 million from a local bank, the SBA, and the city of Eugene. My home is leveraged on all of those notes. My wife is working 50-hour weeks to pay our mortgage while I am unable to pay myself in the development of this business. One of the most important things I wanted to outlay is that we pay taxes like everyone else. We pay state and federal taxes. We will pay taxes on our employees. I pay a high self-employment tax. Even in Lane County, an income tax increase of 1.1% was enacted after the county voters voted against it 3 months before. There is definitely a lot of tax action going on in the state of Oregon right now. I also wanted to point out that whereas I pay all of these taxes, there are many businesses in the state of Oregon that benefit from tax subsidies that my tax money goes towards, and it has taken a lot of effort for us to get here without any tax help at all. I wanted to make it clear to everybody that we are just as concerned with all the programs that have been talked about. These are very serious and critical aspects of the state. My wife and I have voted for the increase of our personal property tax multiple times to help balance some of these issues over the last few years while our economy was bad. Emergency levies and bonds have all been paid by us, and our property taxes go up with little increase in our personal income. I also wanted to point out that under the governor's proposal for the business plan, that he lists the important need for manufacturing jobs that produce goods for sale in and out of the state and pay living wages, and that is what we founded our business to do. I also wanted to make clear, although I'm sure people know, that we have also been very concerned about law enforcement and treatment plans. My home has been broken into two different times and my truck stolen in the last 18 months, and in all cases there were evidence of meth use. But it is not my industry that created methamphetamine use. I have federal tax money that goes to subsidize pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer, who created the drugs that are produced to make methamphetamines on the street. And nobody is going after them for the damage that has been done to our entire nation over this epidemic. In fact, our federal tax money goes to subsidize these companies. It is very, to me, completely alarming and not all right. I never agreed to any of that. I also want to make clear that my company, as well as my own time, spends multiple hours in my free time, what little I have, in the benefit of nonprofit organizations around the state and in the country. Next week, I will be a part of Taste of Eugene, which raises money for the undernourished of Lane County. I help organize a beer fest that raises funds for small programs in Eugene that need help. People who know me know that I'm a charitable person, and I have very little free time to conduct other sorts of hobbies and things. We're very concerned.
Mr. Floyd, if you could wrap
lastly,
up with it. Thank you.
Lastly, I just want to say that as we all try to face the challenges of funding these programs locally, please keep in mind that craft brewing is a positive support of what is going on in the state of Oregon. There is nobody here that is basically trying to tax the other high Oregon products such as dairy creamery, cheeses, kettle chips, or Marion berries or hazelnuts. None of this is becoming forward, and it's just important that you hear that I work really hard for my community and for the state of Oregon. I have also one last thing just to say is that the beer industry in the state of Oregon is connected with the agricultural nature. The 35% of all hops raised in the state of Oregon are in the Willamette Valley. My yeast bank is in Hood River. I've bought stainless steel tanks from Canby and the Dalles, and the grains that I use that are done are given to local farmers who produce non-hormone injected beef for our community. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for being here. Mr. Love.
Yes. My name is Ben Love. Thank you, Chair Reed and committee members, for allowing me to speak. I am the assistant master brewer at a new startup in Portland, Hopworks Urban Brewery. Christian Ettinger, the owner and brewmaster, was here yesterday, but he wasn't able to get away. We're still right in the middle of construction. I just wanted to read a little bit of what he had to say. Our new business is called Hopworks Urban Brewery, and it's a startup organic brew pub on Southeast 30th and Powell in Portland. Our business plan involves a $2 million investment in our facility, half of which was spent on development. We will employ over 30 people and provide organic beer and pizza in an underdeveloped area of town famous for its check cashing facilities, strip clubs, and four lease signs on empty buildings. Our neighbors have expressed a great deal of gratitude for providing them with a family and community-oriented restaurant and spurring a positive change for the neighborhood. The name of the brewery is Hopworks Urban Brewery, which acronym for that is HUB, and we're really hoping that in that underdeveloped part of Portland, this will be the beginning of something new. For myself, I worked for 3 years at the Pelican Pub and Brewery in Pacific City, Oregon, before starting at Hopworks just earlier this month. Some of you may know the Pelican Pub and Brewery is an integral part of the Tillamook South County community. Just in the brewery, when I started there 3 years ago, it was myself and the head brewer. Since then, we have grown to a staff of 4 full-time people, and we have employed a number of interns over the summers from the Fermentation Science degree program at Oregon State University. Like I said, the business supports community growth, both private and public. We've been involved with Brewer Summer Games, which raises money for the local boosters and for Children's Cancer Association, and also the Taste of Tillamook. Any tax increase, whether it's for the Oregon State Police or for mental health or drug addiction, would hurt and threaten the profitability of the company. Even though we've been there for 10 years, I can tell you that we are not making much money yet. It's a very small amount, and any tax increase would greatly lower that. We, for the most part right now, what we've been doing is making some money, but then it all goes right back into the business. The rest of the pub, we have a staff of about 30 to 40 people year-round, and it swells to over 100 people in the summer. I believe that we all agree that these are important public policy issues, but taxing beer producers to pay for drug addiction and mental health doesn't make sense. I've heard a lot of people talk about it's obvious that we need to find a way to fund these groups, but why is malt beverage the one way to pay for that? You know, a lot of people, I don't think I've heard anybody talk about why a beer tax is the right way to go. You know, what about all the other alcohol producers? What about, you know, why are we the ones who are going to pay for addiction to meth and crack and speed and cocaine and marijuana and heroin and people who are huffing things? And all these other addictions that we have, why are only beer people paying for something that is important, you know, public health issue that we should all pay for? Regarding the state police, recently there was a letter to the editor that appeared in the Oregonian that suggested that we tax toilet paper in order to pay for the state police. And I thought that was fairly laughable, but at the same time, for me, it drove home the fact that picking a random product to pay for a service that we all use just doesn't make sense. Thank you.
Thank you. And you can correct my mispronunciation of your last name.
Butenchen.
Thank you.
My name is Brian Butench. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Brewers Guild. I have a bunch of written testimony by people that can't be here. Can I just announce those people?
Yes, that's
perfect. Okay. Let's see. This is from Fred Bowman. He's the founder of Portland Brewing and is a representative of Pyramid Breweries to the Oregon Brewers Guild. He's at the Craft Brewers Conference in Austin, Texas this week. He's also a member of their government affairs committee. This is from Jack Joyce, who's the owner of Rogue Ales, who's also a board member of the Brewers Association, and he's at the Craft Brewers Conference this week. This is from Gary McMahon from Saxco Pacific Coast. He cannot make it here today, but they are a supplier of glass bottles and growlers to the craft brewing industry in Oregon. This is from Lisa Morrison, who's a local beer writer who could not be here today. This is from Adam Roberts, the owner of Main Street Ale House in Gresham, Oregon. He cannot be here today because he's also at the Craft Brewers Conference. This is from Darren Welch, the head brewer at Pelican Pub and Brewery in Pacific City. He can also not be here today because he's at the Craft Brewers Conference. This is from Paula Johnston at Bridgeport Brewing Company in Portland. She cannot be here today, but she would like to submit written testimony. This is from Irene Fermat, who also presented testimony yesterday. She was one of the three people, but she forgot to drop off her written testimony, so there's that. This is actually the written testimony that Ben alluded to from Christian Ettinger, who couldn't be here today. He's the owner of Hopworks Edmund Brewery. He's also the general contractor on his business, and they hope to build the first LEED certified brewery in the United States. This is from somebody who should be here. The Oregon Hop Growers Association and Oregon Hop Commission had a meeting today, and they were leaving at 2, or a little bit before 2 from Woodburn, and so she might be here. If she's not here, I'll submit that at the end. All right, last but not least, here's my written testimony.
Don't feel obligated to read all of the
poems. Yeah, I'm actually not going to read from it at all. But maybe a little bit. Maybe just a little bit. Should I give that to you?
It's fine. Maybe you can do that when you finish. We're hoping to finish soon.
Okay. Yeah. If you guys, please let me know when my 5 minutes is up, because I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Got about 2 minutes left.
Oh well. Okay. 30 years ago, there was one brewery in Portland. If I was to go back in time and talk to that person, somebody that worked at Henry's, who's the only brewery in Portland, if I was to tell them, 30 years from now, you won't exist, your company won't exist, your brewery won't exist, the company Farrell's, they will actually build a restaurant here where your brewery is. They will also sell the most beer of any restaurant in the state. The guy who's in Expose Yourself to Art, print, he's going to be the mayor. Someday down the road, actually this year, there'll be, instead of the one brewery, there'll be 80 breweries in the state, and that'll employ 4,200 people. That there will be an excise tax, a bill to put forward that would raise the excise tax about $35. Obviously, things change a lot in 30 years. The whole excise tax laws were not work out well if you have one brewery, a big brewery in a state that makes a lot of beer and sells beer over a number of states. I'm not sure how well it works when you have 80 breweries and 4,200 employees. I'd like to point out that that as far as the tax rate goes, the average tax rate, if you drop off the six top highest states, it's between $5 and $6. The median in the United States is about $5.88, and I think that works well for an excise tax, and that's probably why the reason most states have an excise tax in that range. So I want to applaud people who are maybe starting to think outside the box as far as how to perhaps work with the excise tax or work on a tax that would raise the money that they need but not necessarily be through the traditional state beer excise tax. I'm not going to come up here and repeat Senator Metzger's mistake about messing with the bottle bill. But that's one thing that crossed my mind. I mean, there's a lot of ways to think about it, but I want to maybe try and outline why a high state excise tax is bad for breweries that operate here.
Very quickly, please.
Okay. I would like to point out that of the top 10 craft breweries in the U.S., all but one got their start in states with low excise taxes. The average was about $2.33 for these companies. Of the top 50 craft brewing companies in the United States, only two reside in states in the top 10 highest excise tax states. Yesterday, somebody said that we didn't have a brewing industry here. And I think 4,200 jobs, with an additional 12 places opening another 200 or 300 jobs this year, I think that kind of refutes that. The one bill that we have before us to raise the tax to $12.40, that's going to cost Deschutes $1 million a year. And when you say Deschutes, when you start the next year, you're going to pay an extra $1 million in excise tax, but brewers in California and Washington will not. If somebody says that's not going to put them at a disadvantage, I have to say
if somebody told me I could save $1 million, if I didn't operate in the state, I would say $1 million is a lot of money. And for House Bill 2535, that's going to be $5 or $6 million for Deschutes. So I want to make sure that people understand that this is really, I think, harmful. The higher the beer state excise tax rate goes, the more harmful it is it's going to be to these breweries. Okay, can I make one more point? The gentleman who went through the Alaskan excise tax rates, that's a lot of work. And I kind of started to do the same thing. I just took numbers, which you can read in my testimony about how a very high state excise tax rate might negatively affect breweries, but also restaurants. But I did also want to make one point, and that's Alaska was up. Small craft breweries in Alaska were up over the time period since the tax. But I do want to point out that cumulatively they were up 23%. The national average over this time was about 32% in Oregon. The brewery's production grew 48%, and the actual growth of in-state consumption of craft beers made in Oregon was up 37%. So I told this to somebody, I said, they did 74% of the average. And he said, oh, that's good. That sounds really good. I'm like, if your kid came home and he said, he told you he got 74% of the average, is that really doing very good? And so I just want to thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you. Other questions for this group? Representative Broom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The gentleman in the middle, tell me your name again.
Ben Love.
Ben.
Yes.
Ben. Okay. Just a comment for Ben. First of all, I appreciate all your testimony. I appreciate your testimony, too. But I would just advocate that the neighborhood you're describing has been the home of my family business for 60 years. It's better than you spin it. I'm glad that you guys are there. Also, it's also real close to the national headquarters for Fred Meyer's, and it's real close to Cleveland High School, which is the alma mater of both my parents, and the school for which my company is going to rebuild the track here, and then starting in the next few months. So it's a pretty good neighborhood, and I'm glad you're there.
Sadly, Mr. Love, yesterday we had someone who made the mistake of taking on Representative Berger, and so one has to do it each day.
And if you'd like to offer a discount to Lawrence Bruin Company employees, just as a sort of offset for what you're
doing. Any other questions?
Thank you. If I could just make one quick point that I forgot. The gentleman before us today, he had mentioned the increase in, and I think Brian tried to hit on this a little bit, but the increase in Alaska's microbrew sales compared with the stagnant sales of the large producers. And honestly, that is part of a national trend. That's nothing specific to Alaska. If you've been paying attention, or if you've been watching the news for the past few years, they've been talking about that, where the large brewers are seeing losses in sales, while us craft brewers and wine producers and hard liquor producers have been seeing, and importers have been seeing, significant increases in their sales.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Yeah. We have three more people signed up on our list. Craig Nichols, Michelle Palacios, and Gail
Goshi.
Thank you.
I have a written testimony here. If I can have Craig. Do you want me to just...
That's fine. She's not here, though?
No, she's still on her way coming from Woodburn. So.
Okay. And our other two folks are here? Okay. Okay, please come forward. I'm sorry, it looked like the line that checked the person after you went through your name, so I was interpreting that from yesterday. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Revenue Committee. My name is Craig Nichols, and my partner is Jason McAdam, who could not be here today. Excuse me. We're a fairly new brewery. We just had our 2-year anniversary. We're Roots Organic Brewery. We're the first certified all-organic brewery in the state of Oregon. We're located in southeast Portland, not too far from where Hopworks is going to be starting up. And and it's a good thing. I had this for yesterday. Hearing everybody's testimonies kind of, you know, you have what I have to say up here about myself and our company. I'll just touch on a few things and some of the opinions that I've kind of gathered since yesterday. You know, we've heard a lot about alcoholism and drug-related problems in the state of Oregon. We know we're one of the higher ones in the country, and it's tragedy. I think a lot of people, I think most people could say they've been touched by a family member or friends of families, you know, that have been in a related drug incident or alcohol incident. And I think most people know how that feels, including myself. And, you know, I do produce beer for a living, and pretty darn good beer, we think. I would like to say that we are a small company, of course. We opened up 2 years ago in March, and we opened up with myself, my partner, our wives, and one employee. We did all the brewing. We did all the bartending. We have a very small pub. Of course, as business owners, we're very responsible in our procedures and, you know, and alcohol consumption with our patrons and our distribution. And again, as most people on our industry side have said, you know, it's not, a lot of these problems aren't directly related to us as a whole. I think there has to be a way, obviously, to find to fund a lot of these programs, particularly the law enforcement side. I think that only helps our business in the future, keeping things in check. As Brian had mentioned, you know, the industry in Oregon is directly affecting 4,200 employees and indirectly over 12,000 employees, as far as that's related with the brewing industry. If those taxes were to go through, particularly 25-35, it would hurt us tremendously. We're in the process of expanding right now. Excuse me. Since we've opened, we went from that, you know, one employee and a couple of helpers, friends, and family, to seven employees. And in fact, this morning I just hired another employee before I came here. And with the expansion, we have, you know, we need to have the need for at least six more employees. With the tax coming anytime soon, and with the expansion of us, that would really hurt and make it almost impossible. You know, Portland's not the most business friendly for small businesses already, unfortunately, and we do pay a lot of taxes. And you know, we're trying to do our rightful thing. My brewery, in particular, I have three kids of my own from 12 to 8, and you know, not only am I personally and my wife personally involved with our kids' school and our community, but we're also, you know, involved in a lot of charitable. We do a lot. I think our brewery does more charitable events than probably anybody I know of in Portland. We don't make a lot of money as owners, but we give a lot to our community and to our schools. And I've always believed that this has to come on the home front. The school districts are not good in our state, particularly in Portland. And we're not getting a lot of funding for that. And I think without education, obviously your possibilities to become a drug addict or an alcoholic and other problems can arise without education of any sort. I think we've got to find a way to start at the home front, make parents responsible, make our schools responsible. And I think just by doing a cut-and-dry tax, it's going to hurt the brewing industry in the community, which is the largest per capita in the world. Surpasses Munich, Germany. And, you know, this is an integral part of the economics in the state. And it's going to hurt the state tremendously because I'll tell you, as Ben Loves mentioned, and Christian Ettinger, they're opening up their new brewery. There's three more organic breweries. We started something. We're hoping to see more of that. That's going to be beneficial for the future, for our environment, for our kids. You know, we spend three times more money to produce our beer than your average brewery. The cost of goods are extremely expensive. But we're willing to do that for the right thing. I want to see my kids grow up in a healthy environment, healthy country, healthy world, clean air, clean water, and good food to eat. And I feel this is one of the ways to go about it, obviously. So, again, you have what I have to say and about us, but I really truly believe that. And I know for a fact this excise tax would really hurt us, and it would probably put us out of business and eliminate anybody else being able to start a small brewery for a long time. We don't have a lot of cash to back it all up. You know, we make it, and we're doing well, and we're looking forward to year three and the expansion. With a tax like this, it'll never happen for us. And Christian's project, I can speak on his behalf because we spoke about it yesterday, He's put a lot more money. He's got a bigger operation. It would kill him. I mean, before he's even opened, it would kill him. And these are the things we have to find the balance to. So I really appreciate your time and your consideration on this matter.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mr. Agbaugh.
Good afternoon. I'm Don Onbaugh. I'm president of Morgan Distributing. We're an Anheuser-Busch, Widmer, Red Hook wholesaler based in Oregon City. The company was founded by my father-in-law in 1959. And incidentally, I'm sure he was looking down on us smiling yesterday. He started out as a Blitz Weinhardt wholesaler, and I'm sure he appreciated the comments yesterday. We are a family-owned business. My Anheuser-Busch counterparts are all family-owned businesses. The Miletuses in Portland have been in the beer business since Prohibition. Western Beverage in Eugene has been in business the same amount of time. Larry Perkins on the coast is into his second generation in the family, as is Bill Wynn over in Nissa. We all have a lot of things in common. We provide family wage jobs with excellent health benefits and excellent pensions. And in addition to providing good jobs, we play an integral part in the enforcement of the many regulations that surround our industry. I think many of you on this committee know that basically the wholesalers and the bottlers make the Oregon Bottle Bill work. As a young law student driving a beer truck the first summer that the bottle bill came into effect, I can tell you it wasn't always so. It started out very, very rough, and it was through a lot of money invested, a lot of time, and a lot of hard work that we've come to a system that basically isn't perfect, but it works pretty well. In addition, we ensure that all of our customers are licensed. We help with the many trade practice regulations that we operate under are basically industry enforced. I can't remember the last time the OLCC was involved in a trade practice problem. And yesterday there was a statement that education works, and we certainly agree with that. We've been behind education in the responsible use of our products for years. We've worked with many law enforcement agencies over the years, and this morning at the warehouse I happened to run across a pamphlet here. The Clackamas County Sheriff's Department has given away thousands of these water safety laminated brochures. At a more practical level, our salesmen, there's been a lot of talk about underage drinking. Our salesmen often can recognize when a customer is selling to underage customers. We tell our salesmen to work with, to counsel them without accusing them, and that's a difficult task. There's often language and cultural barriers there that are sometimes almost insurmountable. And if that customer, in fact, winds up with a citation from the OLCC, I can tell you one of the first things that the OLCC officer, investigating officer, will say will be, go to your local wholesaler and get the booklet that explains all the different IDs from the 50 states. Lastly, as Ralph Groner indicated yesterday, we are all, wholesalers are very actively involved in supporting our community, whether it's the local hospital, whether it's the local community college, the historical foundation, whether it's youth sports, or whether it's a fundraiser for the family whose house just burned down. There's always a beer wholesaler behind it. There's always a beer wholesaler supporting those causes. I'm very proud of our industry. We're good citizens, and we're good corporate citizens, and we would be against any action that would single out our industry for special tax treatment, be that unfavorable or for that matter favorable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you for coming. And since I called their names, two people have arrived, so let's give Michelle Palacios and Gail Goshi a chance to come forward. And as you're coming forward, we've heard a lot of testimony, and we're trying to keep our comments to just a couple of minutes. So please go ahead in whichever order you choose. And if you could start by identifying yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Chair and representatives of the committee. My name is Michelle Palacios. I'm with the Oregon Hop Growers Association, and I do appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thanks for letting us arrive late. We were at a strategic planning session that had been planned for months, but we were able to sneak out early and be here. So thank you. I'm here today to bring some comments on behalf of the hop growers of the state of Oregon and give some background on our industry and its relationship to the brewing industry. Oregon's the second largest hop producing state in the United States. The acreage in Oregon is limited to the Willamette Valley, Marion, and Polk counties, and we're very proud of the long and rich history that the hop industry has had in Oregon agriculture. Hops are used for beer. More than 99% of hops produced are used for beer, the production of beer, and so our customer is the breweries. And so that is why we, of course, are vitally tied to the success of the brewing industry. Oregon hops and the breweries that they are sold to can really be split into two groups, into a 90-10 split. 90% of our hops are used by large brewers. And when I was hearing the testimony yesterday, there was mention of the large brewers. And to us, the names Coors and Miller and Anheuser-Busch are not used casually as large mega brewers. They are our customers. They are a part of the hop industry. We know representatives of those organizations on a first-name basis. They attend our meetings and are important members of our industry. And for the other 10%, the microbreweries, they're vitally important to us as well. They do purchase 10%, which is a smaller amount, but I think that they've done a tremendous service to the brewing industry in general. They have really educated the consumer about the importance of hops and what hops bring to beer, and revitalized the consumer's appreciation of hops and the qualities that they bring to their product. That's really essentially why we're here today, is to demonstrate that that hops are a commodity that are used by the brewing industry, and their success and future success is important to us. And I did want to make a quick mention. I brought some additional testimonies. We had three growers that were unable to be here today, but I brought their written testimony, which was submitted. And I did bring two informational testimonies from researchers at Oregon State University that wanted to make comments about the impact that the brewing industry and hop industry has on hop research and brewing research at Oregon State University. So I wanted to be sure to mention those two, particularly Tom Shellhammer, the fermentation science researcher at Oregon State, and his testimony about the impact that brewing and hops has in his funding. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And if not, I'll pass it on to Gail.
Thank you. We'll do questions after.
Sure. Sure.
Please. Honorable Chair, my name is Gail Goshi. I'm a hop grower, and I'm going to read this because I'm much more comfortable in a hop field than I am here, so it'll be much more succinct. My family's history of growing hops dates back over 100 years. Our grandmother and grandfather harvested their first crop of hops in 1905. The present family farm, which my mother and father started farming as newlyweds in 1943, is now managed by my brothers, Gordon and Glenn, and myself. Through all the years of farming in the Silverton area, hops have been our flagship crop. As with other hop-growing families in Oregon, our hops have found their way into large and small brew kettles. Anheuser-Busch, Coors and Miller, Widmer Brewing, Widmer Brothers Brewing, Full Sail Brewing, and Pelican Brew Pub are all part of the list. On our farm, we work personally with each of these companies. In agriculture today, the focus is to market locally. In the hop industry, local is part of our business history and future. Brewers know where their hops are coming from, in most cases to the specific field and who grew the hops. It's a close partnership that is rarely seen in other agricultural sales. This is not a partnership of one party producing a commodity and the other purchasing, but the support is backed by private research dollars. Through brewer support, public researchers at Oregon State University, OSU Extension, USDA, ARS, as well as other like institutions in hop-growing states of Idaho and Washington, are annually supported in hop-growing research. In addition to this support of public researchers, monies are also awarded directly to on-farm grower-led research projects. Over the last 5 years, research projects based solely out of Corvallis, Oregon, have received private monies shy of just $2 million. This research, which examines disease-resistant plant breeding, reduced use of insecticides and pesticides, integrated pest management, water monitoring and drip irrigation, as well as beneficial health compounds in hops. This ongoing financial support demonstrates the longevity and importance of this close partnership between brewers and growers. As a third-generation hop farmer, I'm very proud of my work, and I find joy in providing employment for a group of hardworking, full-time, and seasonal employees. We are part of a very noble and healthy profession. On behalf of my family and the families of other hop growers, we respectfully request that this legislature continue to recognize the importance of our industry. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for coming. That completes our list of folks who have signed up. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on these several bills? Please come forward.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Mike Palladino. I'm an assistant brewer at the Ram Brew Pub here in town. We thank all of the state employees who come and visit us and patronize us for the last 34 years. I've been here for 5 years in Oregon. I found a craft that I love. That's brewing beer. The community itself gives a very, very much lot into charitable events. I'm here today because my wife and I, our dream is to own our own business. We're hoping that in the near future, in the next couple of years, that we can have the financial stability to do that. I think the bills that are being proposed today would very, very, very affect our chances of owning our own business. I believe the beer industry itself here in Oregon is very, very special. We have a very, very tight community, not only with the brewers themselves, wholesalers, but we have people who are very passionate about the industry themselves. It's a very, very loving community, and I believe I just wanted to be here today to hope that the board here will decide on making it affordable for small people like myself who are trying to start a business to be able to financially have that step and that opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Where is this place, Mr. Chairman?
The Ram? I've heard of it. I went to Willamette University. I think
you can get there with your eyes closed.
You guys actually, everybody here keeps us going, and we've been in this community for a long time because of the fact that it is affordable for us to be here. And I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There is no one else who would like to be heard. We will close the public hearings on House Bill 2347. 2731, 3421, and 3255. And I'm confident that we will at some point return to the subject. Thank you, everyone, for coming and providing your testimony. We will, however, continue, those of us who don't have other obligations, and try and get through some public hearings on the remaining bills on our agenda. And with that, I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3190. And we'll start with a summary of that bill when Mary gets up here. Thanks.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3190 will modify the eligibility for homestead property tax deferral by increasing the maximum household annual income of a qualified senior or disabled person to $40,000. It's currently $32,000. For each year beginning July 1, 2009, the income maximum will also be adjusted annually by the U.S. City Average Consumer Price Index.
Thank you. We have one person signed up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and remaining members of the committee. For the record, I am Sean Swearingen, legislative assistant to Representative Wayne Scott from House District 39. And unfortunately, the representative is away from the building on legislative business, and constituent Joseph Gagnier is not able to testify either. I'm here today to introduce House Bill 3190 on behalf of the representative, Mr. Gagnier. What this bill does is raise the threshold of eligibility for the homestead property tax deferral. The original level was set at $32,000 for a tax year of 2002. House Bill 3190 would raise the maximum to $40,000 in 2009 tax year. This change would allow more seniors and disabled persons to qualify for this tax deferral. And as a note, the original law already adjusts for inflation. This merely adjusts the baseline. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Good explanation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 3190 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3257. Mary, please.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3257 authorizes the state to impose a state ad valorem property tax of $1 per thousand of real market value applicable to property tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2007. The taxes may not be any greater than the amount necessary to repay bonded indebtedness or interest thereon, and establishes a shared services fund in the state treasury for the deposit of these taxes. All monies in the state services fund, including interest earned on the tax revenue, shall be continuously appropriated to the Department of Administrative Services that have yet to be determined. Takes effect in 91 days after signed. Mr. Chair, we've noted several irregularities in the bill, however, which would require some amendments, I believe. Perhaps in the statement at the beginning of the page one, where it refers to the $1 per $1,000 of real market value, but on page two, we're talking about assessed value. So that's one correction. Plus, I've also been requested by the state treasurer that there's no need to basically have them involved in the bill, and if the bill were to go forward, they would probably produce an amendment to that effect.
Thank you. Let's take the comments on the concept then. And first on our list is Mr. Riddell. And Mr. Schellenberg, you're also on the list, so if you'd like to come forward, we can save a little time.
Just two of us, right, Mr. Chair?
That's it. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. We find this bill very intriguing. If it is part of a larger concept that would include an exchange for a portion of the state income tax, there would be dual benefits with that. The state would gain stability with a portion of its revenues relying on property taxes, and counties would gain the opportunity for some growth. It also would diversify both levels of government, the financial portfolio, both levels of government for our joint public service responsibilities. The second point is that we assume that the shared services that are mentioned here but not yet specified are referring to those services shared by the state and the counties that we deliver jointly to, in the red you've seen this chart, this table, that we deliver to joint constituents. And if that's the case, then this will have direct benefits for our joint constituency. So we're very intrigued by this. We would like to see it become part of a larger concept, and look forward to working with whomever would be interested in doing that.
Thank you very much. Schellenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'll make a statement I always make. Property taxes for property-related services. Now, to the extent that state provides property-related services, there may be some rationale for this bill. We've generally opposed statewide property tax because the counties generally provide those kinds of services. In any case, the bill doesn't identify the use of the tax, and so we cannot at this point offer our support to the bill. So we're just offer our concern at this point. Mr. Rydell talks about income tax, portion of income tax being dedicated to this as well. The state does usually provide social services, and social services are correctly financed with a tax based on ability to pay. As Mr. Rydell said, this is an interesting concept. There may be something here, but at this point we would be a little concerned not having identified on the backside what those services are. I'd be happy to see some of the information Mr. Rydell has, but thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Thank you.
Questions. Thank you. Anyone else? Would anyone else like to be heard on House Bill 3257? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3257 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3459. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3459 creates a task force on property tax to study and address fiscal problems caused by ballot measure 5 and 50. The task force shall report its findings to the legislature no later than October 1st, 2008. Sunsets tax force on the convening date of the next regular biennial legislative session, declares an emergency, takes effect upon passage.
Thank you, Mary. Looks like we have a more popular bill here. Lori Satinspiel, Gil Rydell, and Mike Dewey. I don't see Mike here. So moving on. I was going to say call John Chandler, but he's leaving the room. So, Mr. Schellenberg, would you like to come back up? I didn't realize you were all on the same list. I would have said just stay right there. Sorry about that.
Appreciate the exercise, actually.
Chair and dwindling members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel from the Oregon Community College Association. I'm here to ask to be amended to be included at the task force level to be talked about. We do receive revenue from property tax, and we would like to be included in the discussions that deal with our revenue, and that would support this task force moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. You guys can decide.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Gil Rydell, Association of Oregon Counties. As I pointed out before to this committee, the Oregon Constitution with respect to property taxes filled with structural handcuffs that make local flexibility and local financing choices very constrained. In fact, if you try to read, I almost dare you to read Article 11, Section 11, it reads like a Rube Goldberg version of something rather than a constitutional provision. So at the very least, if that could be understandable to the public, or give the public an opportunity to amend the Constitution and make it understandable, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I see a card in front of me here, the addiction counselor. I may need that. I'm testifying too often. House Bill 3459 strikes me that when I look at these, that these are all tax collection or tax user entities. The taxpayers seem to be left out of this task force. It would seem that for this kind of thing to be successful, you're going to have the taxpayers involved as well. I would suggest that those entities should include commercial, industrial, residential, forestry, and agriculture at a minimum, since we are the people who pay those taxes. These are mostly a lot of property-related services here, so it's appropriate that they be on the committee as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. You're all very concise today. Any questions?
Thank you.
That's good. Mike Dewey returned? No. John Chandler, Link Cannon, Marsha Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, and on issues of this sort, definitely not a usual suspect. I wasn't sure whether I should sign up on this bill or the preceding bill, but we're very interested, the home builders are, in finding some path out of the tax tangle in which Oregon has found itself. We believe very strongly, for example, that we probably are in short about $1 billion of road investment, amongst other important services. One of the ideas that we've played around with, and we've actually polled, is changing Measure 5 and 50 as it relates to new development only, from 10 and 5, for example, to 12 and 7, or to change Measure 50's valuation so that new property comes online at the actual value of its construction rather than some artificially reduced value. Particularly if those funds were dedicated to infrastructure, we'd be supportive of those ideas. And the reason I mention them here is not because they fall within the ambit of this bill, but because we would like to be included in the conversation as it goes forward. We share the concerns that have been expressed as to the makeup of the committee as proposed in the legislation, but adding some taxpayers, particularly ones who are willing, as we would be, to step forward and talk about how we could raise our own taxes to buy certain things, we'd be very, very interested in being part of that conversation. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll conclude, take questions if the committee has any, and let you move on.
Appreciate you being here. Appreciate that feedback. Mr. Cannon, would you like to go ahead?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Link Cannon. I'm the Director of Forest Resources Taxation for the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and I would echo Mr. Chandler's and Mr. Schellenberg's comments, which is we believe that taxpayers would need to be part of any task force like this. It would the chances for success would be substantially diminished if we weren't involved in that. So we'd like to, if this bill moves forward, we would like to be involved.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kelly.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm a public policy member of the American Association of University Women of Oregon, and I follow the taxation issues for the association. One of our planks is, or one of our legislative agenda items is equitable and sustainable taxation for the provision of government services. We have amongst our members city councilors, special district members, school board members who all understand the tangled weave of ballot measure 50, 47, and 5 and what those dollars no longer provide. I agree with Mr. Chandler on some of the provisions of putting property on the rolls at a better value and not some artificially constrained value. I also would say that you could entertain something of a cost of living on the cap that's there, because what we are now faced with is if you're on a special district board or on a school board or on a city council or a county commissioner, you are able to spend $5.30 worth of value for the tax dollar when you compare that to the $10 of revenue that you had in 1991 when the cap was there. And we are imploding our infrastructure in our state by having a cap that no longer can buy the same services that it bought when the cap was put in. So anything in the range of discussing this on a logical basis and bringing tax reform to the legislature to have the people vote on would be something that we would support. And we rarely support task forces, but this seems to be a very good broad-based one. I will not offer to be on or have us necessarily represented on, but you could think about some regular people. Thank you.
I'm so disappointed. My time at universities included a lot of task forces. Yeah. Any questions?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wilson.
I think Marcia, actually. I see it in her eyes. She's interested. I mean,
she's making us really recruit her, I think. Is that right? Representative Rosenbaum?
Mr. Chair, that last comment actually was a question that I had in my mind, which is, does any of you have any evidence that voters are prepared to vote for changes in these provisions that are now in the Constitution?
I was going to ask the same question about some of your polling information, if you're willing to share.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I don't recall the exact numbers. We did some polling, and I'll just tell you that any ballot title that starts makes development pay does pretty well. And frankly, you know, it wasn't overwhelming. We actually explored looking at running initiatives, because what's happening in our tax system is, as developers, obviously we have an interest in healthy infrastructure and so on and so forth. We also have an interest in not getting stuck with system development charges for everything that the tax bill doesn't pick up, which has become our funding method of default because we don't have enough tools at the local level to pay for things. So we've been interested in this. We actually looked at running an initiative to change both 5 and 50, as I discussed. Decided not to because it would, amongst other reasons, it would probably have to run 3 to get around single subject, and we didn't have that kind of money. But the interest is certainly there. We all know that 10 and 5 are in the Constitution because people can do those in their head. There's nothing magic about them. It could be 12 and 7, it could be 13 and 8, it could be any combination of numbers. A task force of the sort you're looking at might help us get closer to picking numbers, if there is going to be a cap, that actually reflect the cost of providing government services. And as far as the polling data, I think there's two things. One, the data I've seen, and I think the last election, my personal feeling is voters aren't going to give government a blank check, but the voters are also interested in buying things, purchasing investments in their communities, be it green space, be it transportation, whatever. The other thing is, as I say, if a group like ours, we obviously would have to talk about the details and all of that, come forward and say, we would like to talk about raising property taxes on new development, pay for infrastructure needed by new development. That's not a bad place to start a conversation. And our internal discussions have been that we would be very interested in that because we believe we need the money for water, sewer, roads, et cetera.
Follow up?
Cool. Well, no. I mean, I'm not sure that we heard an answer to the question, but... those were interesting comments.
I'm sorry, I wasn't trying to dodge it. I don't recall the exact numbers. It was, if you follow your rule of thumb, you should start at 65%. It wasn't there. It was in the high 50s, as I recall. But it was a straight-out poll. We did no education questions. We just said, what about this? My personal feeling is, based on other data I've seen, is that the interest might be there, but we haven't invested the kind of money it would take to run those numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. We now look for a big finish with Mike Dewey. I had to call you 3 times, so there's a little expectation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the subcommittee, it's good to see you acting as chair today. You're doing a wonderful job, by
the
way.
Thank you. I'm not sure that's true. I don't have very many people left.
Well, that's because I've got the big finish. Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I looked at this bill a couple days ago, and then I read it. I'm here thinking probably this will be the last opportunity that I have to talk to you about central assessment, and I'm not going to get into that other than to say that if this bill moves forward, and I don't know where the votes are, I haven't talked to anybody about it, but it might be expanded a little bit to look at some of the changes in technology. And I say that because perhaps in 2009 or 2008, we will see a substantial number of companies that are going to see substantially higher property tax bills. Google is moving to Oregon, which is great, in the Dalles. And they're a data company, and there are a lot of companies that have morphed into or are data companies or communication companies technically under the statute. So I would impress upon you that you may see, if we don't have this discussion on central assessment and some specific legislation that's been introduced, that we may have some folks that are going to come back to you at some point in time and say, what happened? And it will be, well, the legislature didn't act because we have a statute that's fairly arcane. So my point today is to ask you, if this bill moves forward, we might expand it, also recognizing that dealing with property tax reform, Measure 5 and 50 specifically, are not easy. So I don't think, but perhaps having some other discussions also might be useful and fruitful. So with that, Mr. Chair, this may be my last opportunity on the record to talk about a subject dear to my heart, central assessment. So with that, I will close, and it is 3 o'clock, so I will get out of your hair, so to speak, unless you have any questions.
Appreciate it. Are there any questions?
We have it on the record. Central
Thank
assessment.
You. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. So close the public hearing on House Bill 3459. Having completed our agenda, I'll also note that we have instruction from the chair that we will not be meeting tomorrow. As I mentioned, the work sessions will be carried over. Mm. And unless there's anything else for the good of the order, we're adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.